ASDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Welcome to Native America Calling. I'm Art Hughes. The case of a murdered teenager in Arizona is spurring a national outcry for justice and awareness for the fact that Native women and girls are victimized at a much higher rate than other groups. And the problem is not just in this country. Another high-profile case in Canada highlights the level of public outcry needed to make progress for missing and murdered Indigenous women. We'll hear about these cases today and how they are changing the narrative. That's right after the news.
This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull, sitting in for Antonia Gonzalez. There are 128 open schools in rural Alaska, and the state owns just under half of them. Reporter Emily Schwing dug through data and found decades of neglect and lacking accountability that's put students, teachers, and staff at risk.
Most school districts in Alaska have access to money that doesn't come from the state, but rural school districts are different.
We do not have a tax base. Most of our community members are families. They live a subsistence lifestyle.
Madeline Aguilar is the superintendent of 9 schools scattered across 12,000 square miles in Alaska's interior. It's roughly the size of Maryland. Her district relies on the state to help pay for everything from textbooks to sewer lines.
The state does have an obligation to provide a public education. Providing that education would also mean assistance with providing the physical space.
Since 1998, Alaska has only funded about 14% of nearly 1,800 project proposals from rural school districts. The result? Exposed electrical wiring and malfunctioning fire alarms. In one case, the school's pipes froze and broke, so for most of the last school year, kids rode a four-wheeler, known as the bathroom bus, home twice a day to relieve themselves.
I think the evidence speaks for itself.
Bryce Edgman, an Alaska native, is speaker of the Alaska State House of Representatives.
And these bright young children show up every morning to go to school in a building that's not fit for even anything but being ready to be demolished.
Regulations say the state is responsible for major maintenance and construction for buildings it owns. Alaska's Education Commissioner Dina Bishop says it's not that simple.
The funding for those projects comes from the state of Alaska's legislature that would provide funding.
This year, requests for investments in school infrastructure statewide come close to $800 million as a budget deficit looms in Alaska. And lawmakers in Juneau are debating over how to balance the budget and fund education.
Emily Schwing reports for KYUK. Support for this reporting comes from ProPublica and the USC Annenberg Center for Health Journalism's 2024 National Fellowship. Indigenous business owners are gathering in a major conference in the Mountain West region this week to discuss ways to bring more business opportunities to Native communities. The Mountain West News Bureau's Yvette Fernandez has more.
Thousands of Indigenous entrepreneurs are gathered in Las Vegas for the National Center for American Indian Enterprise Development Conference, the biggest of its kind in the country. The acting director of the Federal Bureau of Indian Affairs, Brian Mercier, spoke to the group. He acknowledged many conference goers are concerned about Trump administration budget cuts, but said the new administration is also working to enhance opportunities for Indigenous businesses and communities. He told the crowd that energy and economic development are on the table, along with funding law enforcement. He went on to say he's encouraging everybody he speaks with to, quote, jump at these opportunities and work with this administration. Mercier is a member of the Confederated Tribes of the Grand Ronde Community of Oregon. He said in his role, he will continue to advocate for prioritizing Indigenous cultural perspectives in federal policy. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Yvette Fernandez.
And it was roughly 5 years ago this week that COVID-19 came to North America. A Princeton University study has shown that Native people saw greater rates of COVID-19 deaths due to limited access to high-quality medical care, poverty, and crowded living conditions. Tribes shut down many operations and organized vaccine clinics and pop-up testing sites to protect elders and children. This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull in the KLCC studios in Eugene, Oregon.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support from AmeriCorps Vista, whose members serve to alleviate poverty while earning money for college and gaining professional skills. Rewarding service opportunities can be found at AmeriCorps.gov/VISTA. Support by DT Track, your healthcare partner, providing access to a nationwide network of qualified healthcare temporary staff, including medical billing professionals that optimize your revenue cycles. DT Track will be at the Reservation Economic Summit, booth 214. Support by Siri, with a diverse and strategic investment portfolio for the long-term benefit of their shareholders, investing in energy, infrastructure, real estate, government services, and more. Information is available at CIRI.com.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Art Hughes. Native leaders and advocates in Arizona are calling for systemic changes following the death of 14-year-old Emily Pike. The San Carlos Apache teen went missing from the group home she was living in. Her remains were discovered 3 weeks later. It's another tragic reminder of the disproportionate number of Native women and girls who are victims of violence. There are a number of vigils and rallies taking place to remember her and to try and spur some kind of progress toward justice. In Canada, there was progress this week identifying remains of a First Nations woman discovered in a public landfill in Winnipeg. In that case, authorities know who the culprit is, and he's locked up. But it took years of public outcry to mount the search and bring a close to that sad chapter for her family. Both of these high-profile cases highlight the ongoing safety problem Indigenous women face. We are going to hear about that this hour. Please know we are talking about the troubling topic of violence today and missing and murdered Indigenous relatives. If you are sensitive to that subject, today's show might not be right for you. Otherwise, you can reach us by calling in at 1-800-996-2848. That's 1-800-99-NATIVE. Joining us from Las Vegas, Nevada right now is Mary Kim Titla. She's the executive director of United National Indian Tribal Youth, or UNITY. She's San Carlos Apache. Welcome back to Native America Calling, Mary Kim.
Hi, Art. Thank you for having me.
Also joining us from Las Vegas is Jolana Begay Cropa. She is the chief executive officer for the Phoenix Indian Center. She's Diné. Welcome to Native America Calling, Jolana.
Thank you. Good morning. Happy to be on the call.
Well, it's nice to have your voices on the show today. I wish it were under better circumstances. But Mary Kim, let's talk with you first. I want to touch on the effect a tragedy like this has on the San Carlos Apache community. Can you describe how people there are absorbing this loss?
Yes, it's deeply affected everyone in our community. There's been an outpouring of not only concern, but just love and support for the family of Emily Pike. It's amazing to see the outpouring. Really, there have been activities that, serve as a way to show that support. And these include marches and walks. There's going to be a candlelight vigil tomorrow on Saturday at the Apache Gold Casino. And I know there's been great response to that. There's also a large mural that has been painted in the community, and tribal members have been invited to go to the mural. It features a photo of Emily Pike, and they're invited to leave their red handprints around the mural, and there's been a large outpouring there. It has really caused people to be not only concerned about what happened, but still there's some fear because the perpetrator or perpetrators has not been caught. And, you know, I understand that law enforcement is on top of it and they're, you know, conducting their investigations, but there's still lots of questions surrounding how this happened, the reporting time, and, you know, just the family's anguish, you know, what transpired. So it has deeply affected a lot of people.
Yeah. Well, and what you're describing really speaks to the community support that that arises there in Arizona in the face of such tragedy. You mentioned that, I mean, we're still pretty early on in this, I suppose, and the police have work to do. I know that. But a crime was committed. And do you get the sense that people are concerned about how law enforcement officials are handling it? That's something we hear so often in cases like this.
Absolutely. There's always going to be questions, you know, especially when it involves a tribal member and how it's handled. We know that many crimes committed, especially felonies on Indian land, you know, it appears to be treated with less priority, especially, you know, when we have outside agencies coming in. Of course, this happened off the reservation, but there's still questions as to, you know, how this investigation is being conducted. And there's not very many answers. When we do hear from law enforcement, they're still looking for the suspect. So, of course, there's going to be a question surrounding, you know, who has been interviewed, where have they searched, you know, are there any leads at all? And of course, not a lot of information can be revealed. So, you know, that just leads to further questions and concerns.
Yeah. And I know this is difficult news for anyone, I suppose, to process. But I want to ask you about specifically about young people. You work with young people. That is your calling. And do you have a message to them as they try to process this news?
Well, thank you for that question. You know, Emily Pike is the age 14, the age of youth that we serve. It starts at 14 and goes to 24. And Unity has a network of youth councils around the country, and we believe that this is one of the you know, key ways for youth to be involved in positive activities and a way for them to connect with their peers and to you know, just a way for them to gather in safe spaces. And so of course that's something we advocate for. But within this network, there is a group of elected youth leaders, the National Unity Council and Executive Committee, and they represent youth around the country. Every year they conduct a survey to figure out, you know, what issues are most important to them. So they pick the top 10 issues. And MMIW and MMIWP is right up there. I believe it's at number 4. So the youth themselves have done some advocacy work, but also promoting the message of safety. And we do this at our conferences. We take many steps and really give a lot of thought to the safety of youth at our events. So we, you know, we do safety webinars and virtual meeting with our youth so that when they get there, they're fully informed. But it is very important to us. We've created a buddy system where we ask youth not to ever be but alone by themselves at the event, that they should have a buddy, check on their buddy. Of course, you know, there's many ways for our young people to be safe and to keep safe, taking, you know, safety classes, you know, whether it's martial arts or just the, you know, the physical trainings. but just, you know, awareness about the resources that are there for them if they're ever concerned, of course, and they feel, you know, threatened in any way. Who should they call? Who should they turn to? Of course, a caring adult is always important.
Yeah, indeed. Good information. Jelana, I want to hear from you and add your voice to this conversation. You recognized pretty early on you have a responsibility to speak up and organize during this time. What made you get involved?
Yes. So as you know, the Phoenix Indian Center is the oldest Indian center in the country, established 78 years ago as part of federal Indian relocation. And so there are a number of Indian centers set up throughout the United States where we serve as a hub for, you know, the thousands of relatives that live in the major metropolitan area. And our organization has really been a hub that responds to the needs, and we listen to our community, right? So there are different things that surface over time, and MMIP, unfortunately, is one of those crises that really is involving our relatives and has been here for quite some time. And we've always been trying to be engaged in how do we reduce, you know, the number of our relatives that go missing. It is quite tragic. And while I am not San Carlos, I am a member of the Navajo Nation. I am a longtime community member now to the Phoenix area. And from an Indigenous perspective, we're all related and we take care of one another. So learning upon the news of Emily Pike, like, gosh, it was really sad and heartbreaking. And, you know, it's another story. It's another incident that shouldn't occur, right? There are so many layers of these contributing issues that impact. And I think in times like this, there needs to be a unified message for dominant world to understand, well, why is this happening? Why is MMIP such an issue to Native communities? And it really does stem back to the fact that, you know, Indigenous peoples, we've been oppressed for a long, long time. And those different layers, I think, over time add to what's happening today. And as an organization, we're here to support in the ways that we can, which includes sharing of information.
Hey, Jelana, just sorry to interrupt, but we have to go to a break right now, but we want to talk about that on the other side of the break. You're listening to Native America Calling. Decades of neglect by state lawmakers is making dozens of rural public school buildings in Alaska unusable. The schools serve predominantly Alaska Native students. An investigative project by ProPublica and KYUK finds a pattern of severe underfunding for projects that the state is required by law to address. We'll hear more about that on the next Native America Calling.
Support provided by Amerind. Amerind is 100% tribally owned and partners with tribes and their businesses to provide affordable commercial insurance coverage, protect tribal sovereignty, and strengthen Native American communities by helping to keep dollars in Indian country. Information about property, liability, commercial auto, and workers' comp available at Amerind.com. That's Amerind.com.
Way and I.
Thank you for listening to Native America Calling. I'm Art Hughes. We're talking today about Emily Pike. The death of the 14-year-old member of the San Carlos Apache tribe is being investigated as a homicide. It has sparked renewed advocacy and conversations about missing and murdered indigenous women and relatives. You can join our conversation today by calling 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. We're hearing from Jolana Begay Krupa today from the Phoenix Indian Center, also Mary Kim Titla, who is the director of Unity. Jolana, forgive me, I had to interrupt you there as you were getting going. You had mentioned two things, about the contributing factors that go into a tragedy like this, but also that unified voice. And I wanted to give you a chance to finish off what you were saying.
Yeah, thank you for that. So I was mentioning that when something like this does happen, while we many of us did not personally know her, she still is a relative of ours, and it impacts our community in ways that, you know, just it's very, very heartbreaking, and it impacts our entire indigenous community. And, you know, I think that there has been some movement around this. It is definitely a conversation that doesn't go away in indigenous communities, but we need the rest of our community. We need the law enforcement. We need child protective services. We need all of these organizations that support our children to really work together to find ways to avoid something like this happening again. And that, I think, is really the true hope that I have, is that, you know, gosh, we've been saying this. It's been happening. Why does it not make national news? Why are there no documentaries? There's not enough coverage for things to happen. And it has to get this ugly in order for people to pay attention. That makes me really, really sad. It makes me frustrated, but we have to keep moving together, right, to find ways to ensure that this just does not happen moving forward to anybody. I feel that, you know, there's a lot of, again, that layer, the history, is that lack of understanding that dominant world doesn't know about, and it's our opportunity to do that, share out to our community.
Indeed, yeah. Thank you. And I do hear that frustration. And Mary Kim, I want to go back to you for a second. I know that you have a background in TV news there in Arizona. And I want to talk about how this is being talked about publicly. There is a healing way to talk about it, and there's a harmful way to talk about it. Do you have any insights about what people should keep in mind as Emily's name is being brought up in the public conversation?
Thank you for that. Emily is someone's daughter. She's a granddaughter. She's a niece and a cousin. And like Jolana mentioned, she is a relative. And we have all adopted her. We've become that surrogate mother and grandmother and auntie. And so, of course, this is felt very deeply. And I just, you know, want to let the family know, should they be listening, that our prayers continue for their comfort and peace, and our hearts go out to them. This is a very delicate situation because, you know, the family is still trying to find closure. And, you know, the activities, of course, there's going to be a lot of sadness. There's going to be a lot of tears. And we come together to heal. We need each other right now. And there is that delicate side, of course, especially if you're a member of the media. And there has been quite a bit of coverage in the Phoenix area, and the Associated Press did pick it up. And so it has, to some degree, made, you know, some national news, but not to the extent of others that we've seen even recently somebody who was on, you know, a spring break in the Dominican Republic, that quickly spread in the national news. And so, of course, the frustration there with why we're not getting the attention that we deserve. So, you know, we try to do our part. And as somebody who worked in the media before, trying to sometimes serve as a liaison, and this has happened many times where I've been called upon by former colleagues, you know, for advice or just to make connections. So being mindful of our people and our the sensitivities, you know, because I am part of that community and I care deeply and love that community and want to make sure that, you know, there is protective layers.
Indeed. And both you and Jolana have mentioned frustrations. And one of the things I know in this sense, in this situation, that there's a sense that this is now bigger than Emily, right? And this has become a national conversation. Are there some positive things that can arise from this moment? As Jolana said, that this is there are ugly details about this, and people pay attention to those ugly details. But does that then spur some kind of action going forward?
Well, certainly the awareness is important, and I think every opportunity that we have, it's important to talk this through, because while it's difficult and while it is tragic and ugly, we have to keep the conversation going, because we still have many people who are still missing. There have been, you know, so many that have been affected by this, because we might know people. I mean, I personally have been deeply affected because I have three relatives, two cousins and a niece, who went missing and were found murdered. And their killers, to my knowledge, have not been found. So you still have those situations that are ongoing, and it's been years. We still don't have answers. So we have to, you know, keep this at the forefront, demand answers, demand justice, because that's what Emily and her family deserve. They deserve justice.
Yeah. And as you know, your situation and your personal connection to this is not unique. Jolana, what are people at the Phoenix Indian Center saying, and is it different than what you're hearing elsewhere?
Spread out, but we're also very close. And a lot of information continues to travel by word of mouth. We have, you know, obviously some concerned individuals, right? There's a lot of vulnerability that it's still here in our community. Arizona was the Native community were heavily impacted as a result of that sober living crisis that is still here, and that still hasn't gone away. And so it's like this is another layer. So obviously, there is conversation. We are impacted, right? We really have to talk about and acknowledge those who lost their lives and. By MMIP. And I'm always trying to stay optimistic. That's my grandmother's teaching. There's a Navajo a line that she would say, you know, that you have to sort of, you know, try to find the positive in any situation. And I think in this case, you know, there's a lot of grassroots organizations. There are community members that are talking about this and they want change, right? There are task force that are being put together locally, different tribal communities that have victim services units that are established, the Navajo Nation Missing and Murdered, the Dine Relatives initiative. There was even a report that was put out in collaboration with ASU. So there's movement, but collectively, I think we need sort of that unifying. We've got to get together. We're stronger in number in if we're together on our movement. So I feel like this is really a time to look at all of the different work that many of the grassroots, many of the organizations, governor's office, they have an MMIP task force. Okay, what are we doing collectively? I think it's a big step. moving forward. And then I know that there's movement with the proposed bill that's going through, right? I believe it's HB 2281. At the tribal leaders panel here, Governor Lewis is getting ready to go back to provide testimony to push that through. That would be an alert system here for our missing or kidnapped children, specific to indigenous relatives in the state of Arizona. So I'm trying to stay hopeful. Okay, we've got to move together collectively, get on the same page and help one another, share information, give one another resources, right, instead of trying to work in silos. So my hope is that that's a takeaway that will occur moving forward.
You mentioned this, the possibility of an alert system starting there in Arizona. Do you have any sense of some of the other things that could fill in the gaps here that could help improve the situation for Indigenous women specifically?
I would say that I think that what also needs to happen is really just this understanding of MMIP. It's a complex problem that is layers. There's the jurisdiction, there's the history, historical intergenerational trauma. There's all of these different layers that are there, right? The system needs to shift so that there is recognition for our communities that will, as a result, not allow for these types of things to happen. I think that has been long time ignored. When it comes to indigenous communities, it's overlooked. The disparities are clearly there, and we've been saying this. I feel like the movement toward really recognizing, okay, there's truly a gap. There are some disparities that are occurring in these communities. They're not well represented. As a unit, we have to look at that and make changes all the way from law enforcement to, you know, those justice departments, to take a look at what's happening internally that they can change that will help ensure that what happens never happens again. It doesn't matter if it's Indigenous. You don't want this to happen to anybody, right? And so I think that's really something that I'm hopeful that will occur going forward.
Indeed. And do you have any sense as to whether young Indigenous people are more at risk in Phoenix? Are there any factors that contribute to that?
Mary Kim, I'll turn that one to you.
Let's hear from Mary Kim. Yeah.
Well, we know that when it comes to crime and young people, that certainly, if you are a person of color, no matter what age, I think the statistics show that they are at high risk, right? And so that is something that we, want to also see addressed. And legislation is good, but we also have to do our own work at whatever level, the grassroots level, with nonprofit organizations. We try to do our part to educate youth, and Unity certainly is one way to do that, because at the conferences and the trainings, the webinars that we do, we do address some of these topics. And young people are very, powerful with their voices and getting their messages across. I think that Jelana is right. We're starting to peel away these layers, and education is super important, especially with non-natives who may not be aware, and it there's a lot of ignorance that exists. I'm right there as far as making sure that our youth are not at risk for all of these different types of crimes.
Indeed. Well, both of you, I want to say thank you for adding your voice to this and talking with us today. It's not an easy topic to talk about, and we've talked about it many times on this show, and I believe both of you have contributed to that over the years, and I really appreciate how eloquently you bring such a tragedy to your voice to that tragedy and help solve this in some way or another down the future.
Thank you for having me.
Right. I want to bring in now Kim Wheeler. She is joining us from Winnipeg, Manitoba. She's a journalist and host of The Kim Wheeler Show on Sirius XM. She's Anishinaabe and Mohawk. Welcome to Native America Calling, Kim.
Hello, Art.
Hi. Well, thanks again. We only have a few minutes here before we go to break, but I wanted to get into this topic something that's gaining national attention there. And that is the deaths of Morgan Harris and Mercedes Myron, and they are two of the murder victims of a man who is now in prison. And after months of searching in the Winnipeg landfill, there has been a positive identification of remains of one of these women. You covered the story of these two missing women as a journalist. Do you think you brought something to the story as an Indigenous journalist that you thought was missing elsewhere?
You know, there was so little information that came out of the finding that there wasn't really anything we could do, except we did, and I say we because I co-wrote with my colleague at the New York Times about this. Cambria Harris, Morgan Harris's daughter, asked for privacy during this time, and we respected that. We did not go to the family and ask for comment. We were like, you know what, this is what they're asking for, let's do this. And then I guess maybe just a little bit of the wording, because here in Canada we say Indigenous women, and Indigenous covers First Nations, Métis, and Inuit. So we have to be very specific about the language, right? Because if you just say First Nations, then you're discounting women from the Métis and the Inuit community. So there's those little nuances that happen that I think perhaps an Indigenous reporter will see as opposed to a non-Indigenous reporter.
Yeah, indeed. We're going to go to a break here pretty quick, and we'll talk to you again on the other side of that. We're talking with Kim Wheeler, who is in Winnipeg, Manitoba. And the subject of that is news this week that there were remains identified of one of the victims of a serial murderer in Winnipeg. And it's one of those issues that really brings to light the amount of resources and outcry it takes to get this topic to the forefront. If you want to join our show today, you can just call us at 1-800-996-2848. We'll be back right after this break.
Trickster Cultural Center in Schaumburg, Illinois hosts a youth powwow May 31st, Pride Celebration June 7th, and the National Gathering of American Indian Veterans July 18th and 19th. Info at TricksterCulturalCenter.org, who support this show. Skugtash. For more than 40 years, Ramona Farms has revived ancient traditional foods. Tepary beans, pinoli, polentas, and more, all from store.ramonafarms.com. Ramona Farms supports this show. Omnye. If you see a teen or adult suddenly collapse, it's important to act fast and start hands-only CPR. Call for emergency medical help and an AED. Push hard and fast in the center of the chest, giving 100 to 120 compressions per minute until help arrives. Learn more from the American Heart Association about the life-saving skill of CPR at heart.org/nation. The American Heart Association supports this show.
Support by AARP. If someone asks you to buy gift cards to pay off debt, it's a scam. Imposters will claim your Social Security number's at risk, or your utility company will stop service due to late payments, or you won the lottery and only need to pay some upfront costs. They'll say the fastest way is to buy gift cards and share the numbers on the back. Anyone who tells you to pay a debt with a gift card is a scammer. More information on gift card scams at aarp.org/giftcards. Support by the American Indian College Fund, providing millions of dollars of scholarships to Native students every year. Applications are accepted through May 31st at collegefund.org or by phone at 800-766-FUND.
Support from AmeriCorps Vista, whose members serve to alleviate poverty while earning money for college and gaining professional skills. Rewarding service opportunities can be found at AmeriCorps.gov/VISTA.
Welcome back to Native America Calling. I'm Art Hughes. Thanks for being with us today. We're talking about a couple of cases that have caught the nation's attention related to missing and murdered indigenous relatives, one of them in Arizona. And we're also now talking about one in Canada that you may have read about. We're talking with Kim Wheeler, who is a journalist and the host of The Kim Wheeler Show on Sirius XM in Winnipeg, Manitoba. She's an Anishinaabe and Mohawk. And Kim, you talked a little bit before the break. You were talking about the nuance in terms of terminology and how to refer to people in Canada. That's something I really appreciate. That's something we don't always know about here in the States. And I'm wondering if that's something that, as you worked with other journalists on your team, with the New York Times, for instance, that you had to educate them about how to approach the topic, or it, not just in terminology, but in terms of sensitivity?
Not so much with the Times, because that's just something that I've recently started working with. But previously, with the public broadcaster here in Canada, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, the CBC, they did a database of missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls back in, I think it was around 2015 or so, and they put a lot of resources into building this database of over, I think, like 270 different women. And it was really great. And then they promised that they would keep the database current, and they haven't. And a lot of Indigenous women, a lot of Indigenous journalists contributed to that. And they weren't always treated with sensitivity, because when you're an Indigenous journalist telling these stories, you're telling these stories about our relatives. You have a connection to that community, right? And so how they dealt with it afterwards, like, they were not given the support or, you know, maybe therapy that they needed. So it's really difficult for them. Whereas non-Indigenous journalists who also worked on that, they did get a leave of absence and they did get to take time off. But the Indigenous women just had to keep going. And I think, you know, they also did that because these stories are important to them. It was more than just another job. It was something that comes from, you know, their heart, and they understand how the families are feeling and that it could be one of our own relatives. So that's, you know, that's a big difference when we talk about coverage. Like, the non-Indigenous journalists can just walk out the door at the end of the day and go and enjoy life, whereas the Indigenous journalist continues to carry those stories with them.
Indeed. Great. Thank you for that very much. And I want to bring in another voice here. Also from Winnipeg, Manitoba, is Sandra De La Ronde, and she is a missing and murdered women, girls, and Two-Spirit Persons advocate. She's a member of the Cross Lake First Nation and Métis. Welcome to Native America Calling, Sandra, and feel free to further introduce yourself.
Thank you so much. I would also say I'm a grandmother and mom, and, you know, and all those roles are connected with how we live our lives each day, and just trying to make the world a better place for our loved ones.
Indeed. Right. And I wanted to ask you about this case in particular. This has been just years in the making. And do you think that the remaining feeling among Indigenous people there is one of frustration or triumph that we have reached this sort of grim event of progress this week?
I think, you know, we're very grateful that Morgan Harris has been identified, that, you know, there is still to be identified another for Mercedes, but as important for these two loved ones with family is that of Mushkadebe Ziakweaben, who, you know, was claimed by our community to be one of ours, one of our own as an Indigenous woman, and was given a name, Mushkadebe Ziakweaben. And so we know the search is focused on Mercedes and Morgan, and we're so grateful, you know, for that. But also, Mushkadebe Ziakweaben has been claimed by the community as one of our own, and it's so important that she be recovered as well and her family identified. Otherwise, as she continues to, to represent the marginalization of Indigenous women, our voices and our families, without, you know, being able to find, and support her and her family in this recovery as well. And I also want to recognize the late Rebecca Contois, and, you know, it was her finding that led to an understanding and discovery that we did have this one serial killer in Winnipeg. And, you know, maybe not the only one, but certainly, and in this case, you know, was able to identify four Indigenous women that were vulnerable and were targeted and were murdered by this one individual. So even though the case was brought to trial and he was found guilty of four counts of first-degree murder, what was significant about that case is that Mushkadebe Ziakweaben as well remains unknown, but her she was still identified as one of the individuals in the case. So that was important. So we want to continue to advocate for her return as well.
Indeed, that's all important names to remember. I want to bring one more voice in as we still have time. Also in Winnipeg, Manitoba, is Kyra Wilson. She's the Grand Chief of the Assembly of Manitoba Chiefs. She's from the Long Plain First Nation. Welcome back to Native America Calling, Grand Chief.
Hello, thank you.
And as you know, we're talking about the news that has surfaced from the search for Morgan Harris and Mercedes Myron. And after months of searching in the Winnipeg landfill, there has been this positive identification of the remains of one of the women so far. And it was not easy to get to this point. And I'm wondering, in the face of such a major tragedy as this, do you have any sense of progress today?
Yeah, you know, I definitely think that there is progress that when we look at, you know, the greater community and the allies that, you know, have come forward and, you know, have supported the families and supported the work. And so, you know, that greater awareness, you know, even internationally, nationally as well, it's just, even though it's such a difficult time for everyone, it's still very beautiful to see everyone come together. And, you know, even with the discovery of remains, you know, it is very much a sad time because it does provide that confirmation. But that is exactly what we were wanting to do was to bring our women home, bring our family members home, and we've been able to do that so far for one of the families. And so I'm just grateful that, you know, even during a sad time, that there's some sense of closure is my hope for one of the families.
Indeed. And one of the things we've just touched on here is the amount of resistance there was to performing the search.
Mm-hmm.
And that changed mm-hmm. when Wabkinew became Manitoba Premier. And does that say anything to you about Indigenous leadership in Canada?
Yeah, well, you know, we really had to fight against one of the, you know, former government that was, you know, in power at that time, which was just an awful time that they used, you know, their own campaign dollars and used it to further traumatize families that are, you know, dealing with this. And so when we look at our premier, who is First Nations, which is just amazing, you know, everyone's just so happy and so proud of the work that he's doing. And so, you know, whether you're First Nations or you're non-Indigenous, you know, we are talking about human beings. And that is, you know, a sense of compassion and empathy that we should all carry for one another.
You've been a political leader for a long time, and you just assumed the leadership of the Assembly of Manitoba Chiefs. And do you have a sense of how you intend to use your voice now in this new position to change the narrative?
Yeah, definitely. When we look at the inquiry that we had completed within Canada, the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls Two-Spirit inquiry, there were 231 calls to justice. And right now, you know, we are not even anywhere close to being halfway there. We need to continue on to make sure that we're supporting our families that are impacted by the crises that we see all over the world when it comes to Indigenous women and girls, Two-Spirit, and men and boys. And so we really need to work together to ensure that we're finding solutions to the crises that we're seeing right now.
This case gained a lot of national attention. Do you get the sense that people in the position to make decisions now are listening?
I believe so. I think that there's definitely going to still be some resistance, and you know, we're ready for that. I think we have been ready for that, and we'll continue to fight for justice for our people and for our families.
And not to dwell on it too much, but it took a considerable amount of time and resources to get where we are today. Are you concerned about how much energy it takes to make progress for Indigenous people in Manitoba or, you know, the rest of Canada?
I mean, when I think about our ancestors and what they've had to do to allow for us to be here today, there was so much that they had to do, and you know, this is you know, our responsibility in terms of completing, but continuing on with that work that our ancestors fought for us to be here today. So, I mean, it's just the roles and responsibilities from one generation to the next. And, you know, we, well, I'll only speak for myself, but I know that our people are ready to continue on that fight.
And we, this whole show, I mean, all of us, I think, have talked about missing and murdered Indigenous relatives in a sense that this is a discussion that we know about, I think. But do you think that this is something that the majority of Manitoba understands?
You know, there is definitely some people that have an understanding. I feel like maybe some people don't know some of the questions that they may have. They don't have the answers, and sometimes people may be afraid to ask questions just due to the respect or not wanting to offend anybody. And so I think that there is that level of education that we still need to continue in making sure that, you know, everyone understands, you know, what it is that First Nations people deal with, what it is that, you know, Native Americans deal with. It's just really an ongoing conversation that we'll continue to have.
Do you have any confidence in the incoming Prime Minister Mark Carney that things might improve?
I'm always hopeful. I don't know exactly what his plans are, you know, with his with his speech most recently, he did not acknowledge First Nations people, which I thought was very surprising. And we'll see. You know, he has a responsibility to work with First Nations people, and you know, as we've shown, that you don't want to work with us, we'll just get louder and louder. So, you know, it'll be a good thing for him to work with First Nations people.
Yeah, and do you get a sense that there's a law that needs to change right away that you can, like, to focus on something, some sort of policy change that you can bring about right away?
Yeah, you know, there's so many. Like, when we look at First Nations people, our whole lives are surrounded by legislation. You know, legislation dictates a lot of the working, policy and legislation really impacts our day-to-day lives. And so you can look anywhere in terms of changing legislation. It could pertain to the health of our people, our nations. Policing and community safety needs to change for the better. You know, housing and homelessness, that's another area. Child welfare, like everywhere you look, all of these systems, our people are stuck in these systems, don't know how to navigate it, and these systems were set up to fail our people. And so we can just look in every direction and, you know, change any legislation or policy that, you know, impacts us every single day.
Okay. Well, that's a topic for another show. We are out of time. And Grand Chief Wilson, I want to thank you for taking the time to talk with us today and really appreciate you adding your voice to the conversation.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
And I also want to thank our other guests, Kim Wheeler, Jolana Begay-Kropa, Mary Kim Titla, and Sandra De La Ronde. And you can join us tomorrow for another conversation about a pattern of neglect for public school buildings in Alaska that have a mostly Native student population. I'm Art Hughes.
Expertise in energy, housing, land use, fire protection, and more in multi-jurisdictional environments helps tribes leverage existing assets, grow capacity, and gain competitive advantage. SE Renewal supports this show. SEERenewal.com.
Support by Sanofsky Chambers Law, championing tribal sovereignty and Native American rights since 1976, from opioids litigation to treaty rights to tribal self-governance, with offices in Washington, D.C., New Mexico, California, and Alaska. Sanofsky Chambers Law.
This program is supported by AmeriCorps Vista. Through service with AmeriCorps Vista, you gain valuable professional experience and leadership skills while helping organizations in your community alleviate poverty. Find a service opportunity at AmeriCorps.gov/Vista today. That's AmeriCorps.gov/Vista.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service.
on the plate for you. To eat nothing to